This message was recorded live at Lighthouse Christian Center in Puyallup, Washington, and is designed to inspire and encourage you in your Christian journey. To find out more about Lighthouse, check out our website at www.lighthousehome.org.
You guys, you know, when I was growing up, I've always loved movies and stories, and when I was growing up, the heroes were people like John Wayne and Clint Eastwood and Harrison Ford, and then later on, people like Tom Cruise came along and Keanu Reeves, and then, of course, today, Christian Bale and Leonardo DiCaprio are there. And here's what you find out about all these guys. In the movies, they are heroes. They are poised. They are assertive. They are assured. They are self-sufficient. They are daring. They're even cocky. These are the kind of people that we see on the screen. In fact, if you look at movies, what you figure out is that the hero in the movie is tough. He is outdoorsy kind of a guy. He is a testosterone-driven hunk. Okay? Well, guys, maybe all those images that we've been watching for so many years now is one of the reasons that we find it a little bit difficult to understand the Bible. And really, especially the stories in the Old and New Testaments. You see, the Bible is not obsessed with image. In fact, most of the time in the Bible, God uses servants, not heroes. And many times, the servants don't fit the kind of conventional ways that we would normally see heroes. But friends, that's great for all of us. Why? Well, because most of us are not poised. Most of us are not assured. We're not assertive. Most of us, can I even say it? We have weaknesses. Most of us are not perfect, okay? And that is the reason, by the way, that Paul said or wrote in 2 Corinthians 12, I'm going to read it to you. It says this, "But he," talking about God, "said to me, my grace is sufficient," and grace is always in the Bible enabling power. That's one definition of grace. "My grace, my enabling power, is sufficient for you. For my power is made perfect in weakness. Therefore, I will boast all the more gladly about my weakness, so that Christ's power may rest on me." What does he mean? What is God saying here? He's saying, my power is most fully demonstrated when my people are weak. You're saying, well, Art, is God putting me down? Is he saying he wants me to be weak? No, he's saying, when my people understand how weak they are, what happens? They turn to me, and they find my power and my strength. Now, when we come to Gideon in Judges 7 and 8, we are going to see how our weakness results in power and results in victory. We're going to look at the Old Testament equivalent, essentially, of 2 Corinthians chapter 12. And as we do that, we're going to see some lessons from the book of, from these two chapters that are going to help us understand just how this principle works. Now, the first principle or the first lesson is just simply this. God insists on the necessity of our weakness so that we will trust in him. Now, friends, Gideon, I want you to know this. The whole chapter 6, 7, and 8 is all about Gideon's weakness. It's a theme throughout this entire narrative. Read with me chapter 7, verse 1, and we'll begin this story. "Early in the morning, Jerubbaal," that is Gideon, "and all his men camped at the spring of Herod. The camp of Midian was north of them in the valley near the hill of Moreh. The Lord said to Gideon, 'You have too many men for me to deliver Midian into your hands in order that Israel may not boast against me that her own strength has saved her.'" So, guys, remember, this is the eighth year in the row the Midianites are coming against the Israelites. Last week we talked about how for seven seasons in a row, this big horde of Midianites on their camels would come in right at springtime, and they would strip the land of all the food, all the best stuff, and they would go away, leaving Israel in the dirt. And that was, here it was again, the eighth season. And we're going to find out a little bit later that Midian has 135,000 soldiers gathered, and these soldiers are heavily armed. Now, Gideon, the Lord had raised up Gideon, right? And he already had one victory under his belt, and he's now called Jerubbaal, meaning Baal fighter, Baal conqueror. So he's already got one victory, and what he's done is raised a little army. And the army of Israelites that he's raised, 32,000 guys, trying to fight off these people from Midian. Now, the reason we've stopped here is because verse 2 is the key to understanding this narrative. Friends, when you read an Old Testament story, look often for a key verse in that story. Often it's something that's said to the main character or something the main character says, because often that will be the key to interpreting that passage. And we have the key. I've stopped here because the key is right in verse 2. It says, God says, Israel has too many guys. That's the key. Why? Because when Israel wins over Midian, and if they had 32,000 guys, they would say, weren't we great? Man, you know, God was, he was kind of in the background somewhere, and we could have called on him if he really needed him. But man, look what we did. We didn't even need him to come around and help us. We were so great. You say, Art, would Gideon do that? Would really Israel do that? That would be so bad, you know. Well, friends, what does this verse point out? It points out that for all of God's people, all of us have a little bit of a tendency to glorify our own efforts. We have a little bit of a tendency to trust in our own proven methods and to credit our own contributions and to think how clever we are. You know, you ask God for a job, and so you get a job interview, and then you come out of that, and you get the job, and you say, wow, what a great interview I gave. That was so cool. I'm good. Okay. Or you say, God, you got to give me wisdom as we buy this house. And you go in, and the guy comes down 10,000 bucks, and you go out saying, man, what a negotiator I am. It's amazing how good I am. That's what happened. That's our tendency. So would have Gideon have done that? Might have done that? Might have Israel have done it? Of course. And to combat that tendency and foster trust, God often, frequently insists that his people be reduced to utter helplessness. That is, that we begin to recognize that we are weak and our only deliverance, our only chance is to turn to God, to trust in him, and then to experience his power. Now, so let's just admit it. Judges 7:2 is for all of us too. This isn't just for Gideon. This isn't for Israel. It's for all of us because we have a tendency to rely upon ourselves. And that's the reason God insists on the necessity of our weakness. In fact, he even says, I think if you look at 2 Corinthians 12, you really say, God's saying, get comfortable with your weakness, okay? You kind of live in your weakness. And if you look at verses 3 through 8, you see how God does this for Israel. Now, we're not going to read these verses, but I'm going to tell them to you. I'm going to describe them. On one side, you have the veteran Midianite force of 135,000 Midianites, heavily armed, and they have come again to Israel. On Gideon's side, you have 32,000 inexperienced people, warriors, with very few weapons. And as Gideon was contemplating this thing, okay, God, it's 4.5 to 1. We have no tools really to fight. This is going to be really tough. As he's thinking about that, probably, here's God saying, you got too many guys. And you can just see Gideon kind of go, what are you talking about? No, you got too many guys because I want to prove to you that it's not you, it's me. So he says, I'm going to help you cull this group of guys. Now here's what he does. He says, first thing you do is tell everybody, if you're afraid, go home. What do you think the result of that was? 22,000 guys leave. So now they're down to 10,000 guys. And what does God say? Now, you know, Gideon said, oh, 12 to 1. That really helped us, God. But God doesn't, he's not finished. He said, no, 10,000, still too many. Look what he says in verse 4. But the Lord said to Gideon, "There's still too many men. Take them down to the water, and I will sift them for you there. And if I say, this one shall go with you, he shall go. But if I say, this one shall not go with you, he shall not go." So he's saying 10,000, still too many. Why? Because you're still likely to say, "We did it, and we don't really need God all that much." So God says, "I have a little method for you. Take the guys down to the little brook that was right there, and have every man take a drink of water." Here's God's method. And he says, the guys who lap up water with their tongues, that is, they probably had to get down on their stomachs and get right next to the water and lap up with their tongues, "I want you to send all those guys away. And then anybody who takes the water in their hands up to their mouths, then I want you to keep those guys." So they go through the whole thing. Guess how many people got down on their stomachs? 9,700. And now Gideon is down to 300 guys. What's going on? Well, he's insisting on the necessity of their weakness. He's putting them in a position where they cannot possibly think that the things that they do are the things that are going to win the victory. In other words, he's putting them in a place of dependence upon God. Now, here's something I want you to see. If you've ever heard a message from Judges 7 before, and probably many of you have, you've heard a message, and some pastor, or maybe you've read a commentary that said, "Hey, listen, God had his method was very pointed here. What he was doing, he was looking for valiant men. He was looking for brave men. And so anybody who got down on their stomach didn't care that there was an enemy a mile or two away, a couple miles away, and so they just got down there and got their water. But anybody who kind of kneeled down and got the water for their hands and kind of, okay, they're looking for the enemy, you know, those are the guys God wanted." Here's the problem. Here is the problem with that way of thinking. It's not in the text. Okay, that's a problem, guys. There is no particular virtue in kneeling. There is no particular vice in lapping with your tongue. It's not in the text. It's amazing how virtuous the hand lappers become in many pastors' minds, okay? But what's God's point? He tells them in verse 2 how necessary it is for God's people to be weak. Is he now telling them, "Yeah, but with 300 really good guys, I can do so much"? I don't know. He's not telling them that at all. This is just simply a way of culling the group down. There's no special virtue in these guys. That would work against what we know the theme of this passage is. And guys, that's often God's method. He brings us to a point where we understand, oops, I am not enough. I don't have enough. I don't have enough skills. I'm not enough. And then God beautifully works through us. I was reading this week about revivals. I read of one revival that happened in Scotland in the 1740s. And the guy who was participated in this revival, he was a pastor there, parish pastor. His name was William McCullough, and this guy was a Hebrew scholar, but he was a terrible preacher. In fact, the reports of that time said that his parishioners, a lot of times, in the middle of his sermons, would go down to the local tavern for a few brewskis. You know, I mean, he was not a riveting guy. And yet, in 1742, one day, there's 30,000 people on a hillside, and God is using him, and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people get saved. They come to a saving knowledge of God and begin that relationship. Now, I just think that's God's, first of all, it's God's sense of humor, maybe, but it's also him wanting to tell us over and over and over again, no, it's not about you. Yeah, you've got to be willing. Yeah, I want you to turn to me, but it's about me. And so you just got to get comfortable with your weakness. And when I say weakness, please do not think that I mean kind of a false weakness like, yeah, I know how strong enough, I know how many brains I have, I know how capable I am, but, you know, kind of with God, I'll be humble. You know, no. No, it's not something like that. It's, I want you to understand, this doesn't mean that you're some glob of jello. This doesn't mean that you're a whiner. It doesn't mean that somehow you're pale and anemic. In fact, you may feel quite strong, but it doesn't matter how you feel. You may feel like Brett Latton. It doesn't matter. Okay? Listen, it's not what you feel, it's what you are. And that is, you are weak. Why? Because your human resources are never enough apart from God. That is, you're weak in the sense that by yourself, you are never enough. God has got to be your source of power and strength and help. Now, some of you are going, well, Art, you know, I'm doing pretty well. You know, I'm competent, I'm well-educated, I'm whatever. Listen, let me tell you about my treadmill test. You're going, wow, that was out of the nowhere. Okay, but let me tell you about my treadmill test. It relates. I did a treadmill test about 2-3 years ago, and you go in and you start running on the treadmill, okay? And you think, yeah, I'm in pretty good shape. Yeah, man, I can handle this treadmill. I'm going to impress them so much with my treadmill test. It's going to be so great. They're going to think I'm 25 years old by the time I get off this treadmill. So I'm running. And then, so I'm running for 10 minutes or so. And then she says, the nurse comes in, she says, oh, she jacks up. Pretty soon the thing is going like this. Okay, she tilts it. So now I'm. Let's face it, I'm starting to labor a little bit. And, okay, boy, this is tougher. She comes a little while later. She sees I'm still running. So then she speeds it up and jacks it up some more. Here's what the nurse will tell you about a treadmill test. The treadmill always wins. That is true. And the reason I talk to you about that is, listen, you may be competent, you may be living this life pretty well, but there is always going to be something that is going to come up in your life that is bigger than you. It is going to happen. And there's going to be a psychological, emotional, spiritual something that's overwhelming to you. And you will not be able to handle it on your own. That's all God is saying. You are weak. You need me. If you're going to get something accomplished in life, if you're going to handle what's going on in your life, you will need to depend upon me. So, guys, God isn't even that interested. I don't think he's as interested even in the victory as we are. In fact, if you get a victory and become self-confident, that's worse than having lost. Because God doesn't want you self-confident. He wants you God-confident. And in fact, that's what I think 2 Chronicles 26 is so sobering. Because King Uzziah, it says something very interesting about him in 2 Chronicles 26. It says this, his fame spread far and wide, for he was greatly helped, until he became powerful. But after Uzziah became powerful, his pride led to his downfall. Guys, here's God, he intervenes for us, we think, oh, God was great. And then pretty soon, we kind of forget God's part, and we remember our part, and then pretty soon after that, We're believing our own press releases, okay? Where we're going, wow, I am really good. I am good. Listen, here's what you should remember. You can never be too small for God to use, but you can be too big. You can never be too small, but you can be too big. Where you think, man, I am so excellent. God is lucky to have me such a leader. I'm so good. And listen, you have that attitude, believe me, you are in a bad spot. My staff will tell you, they get tired of hearing me pray. We'll be praying a Sabbath, and I'm saying, Lord, you got to keep your hand on the church. You got to keep your hand on all of us. Lord, we're so dependent upon you. We need you, Lord. Why am I praying that? Because I realize that nobody is indispensable, and certainly not me, and that it's all about what God is doing and what he's doing through every one of us here at Lighthouse. So I guess I'm wondering, guys, what are you trying to do alone? What are you trying to do maybe on your own strength? And God is saying, no, get comfortable with your weakness. Get comfortable with it, because it will always make you then turn to me. and that'll be the best thing in your life. You'll certainly see more victory. You'll certainly see more, you know, all those things. But also, you'll have your head screwed on straight about where the victory came from. And you'll be dependent upon the Lord. Now, God insists on the necessity of our weakness. That's a great lesson. But there's a second lesson here that is so encouraging to me. Lesson number two, if we listen to God, if we listen, then he will encourage us in our weakness and help us take action. Look what he says in verse 9. During the night, I don't know why God speaks to Gideon at night so much, but here it is. The Lord said to Gideon, get up, go down against the camp, because I'm going to give it into your hands. Verse 10, if you are afraid to attack, go down to the camp with your servant Purah and listen to what they're saying. And afterwards, you'll be encouraged to attack the camp. So he and Purah, his servant, went down to the outposts of the camp. Guys, Gideon is such an unheroic hero. He's so encouraging to me. That's why I like him so much. Here, Yahweh orders him to attack the camp. Okay, it is time. Get in, get up, and go get the job done. But if you're afraid, you need a little encouragement. If you're afraid still, you need a little encouragement. I have a little encouragement lined up for you. Gideon is just, he's not the conventional, crusty, immovable man of steel. He's not, he doesn't have a lot of true grit. And God knows it. And the text proves it. Because Gideon takes God up on his offer. And the next two verses, we won't read it, but I'll tell you what happens. Gideon and Purah, his servant, go down. They kind of sneak down to the other camp, the Midianite camp. And they, what do you know, are just in time to hear two privates talking. Two privates in the Midianite army. And here's what one Midianite private says to another Midianite private. Here it is. Hey, dude, you know, I had this dream. And I don't, how do we get these dreams? We're so strange, but I hate to even tell you this, David, it's so strange, but what happened was I dreamed a loaf of barley bread came rolling into the camp. And this loaf of barley bread comes to a tent and it smacks right into the tent, and the barley bread turned the tent upside down. Go figure. I have no idea what that means. And the other private says, oh man, I know exactly what that means. That can only be the sword of Gideon. And God has given us into his hands. And the first private goes, of course, I should have known. You know, that barley bread thing, I knew I should have known that. No, that's not, he didn't say that, but... All I've said, it meant God orchestrated here a little bit of encouragement. And since the Bible tells us that the heart of the king is in God's hands, that means the hearts of privates are in God's hands. And sovereignly, he got some encouragement for Gideon. And what happens? Gideon, verse 15, Gideon's response. When Gideon heard the dream and its interpretation, he worshiped God. He returned to the camp of Israel and called out, get up! The Lord has given the Midianite camp into your hands. Wow. Guys, here's what I want to say. The Lord knows the fears of his servants. He knows how frightened that we can become when that situation happens that we never dreamed would happen. We know he knows how frightened we can become when we don't see the resources at our command that we really perhaps want or need. He knows how frightened we become. Guess what Psalm 103:4 says? He knows our frame. I love that passage. What does it say? God knows what we're made of. He made us. He knows where our hearts are. And he's not so strict or harsh when we tremble. He doesn't ridicule us in our fears. He never mocks us. In fact, the exact opposite happens here. What does God say? Go down and get the job done, Gideon. Oh, but if you're afraid, I have a little encouragement for you. I mean, guys, Christ is not looking for someone who is necessarily dynamic or assured or confident or brash or fearless or witty or adventuresome, any of those things. Don't think that you're unsuitable for God in the midst of your challenge or whatever. Christ takes uncertain and fearful people and strengthens their hands in the oddest of ways to make them able to stand for Him at work, in the home, in school, in our communities. He does it. We must never forget how the Hebrews of faith, or the heroes of faith, are described in Hebrews. Look what it says in Hebrews 11. Here's what it says about the heroes of faith. They were weak people who were given strength to be brave in war and drive back in foreign invaders. I love that. They were weak people who were given strength to be made brave. Wow. And you see that right here. Now, we weren't able to look at the whole fleece episode last week because we didn't have enough time. But if you're a new Christian, or maybe you're exploring Christianity and you've never heard about this fleece deal, don't worry about it, because it's approximately the same thing. We're not going to take time to read it. It's in your outline. But you remember that in chapter 6, Gideon says, "Hey, God, if you will save Israel by your hand as you have promised, then do something for me." And then he goes into this whole fleece thing. And he says, "God, listen, I'm going to put a fleece out, and would you make it so the fleece is wet, but the ground all around it is dry? If you do that, I'll know your promise is true." God does it. Then he says, "Okay, God, I just one more time. Would you make it so the fleece is all wet, but then the ground around it is dry?" That would have been an even bigger miracle, because, of course, wool would have absorbed moisture. That would be a pretty big deal. So that's what God did. Now think about it. Gideon knew that what God had promised. So this isn't maybe unbelieving. It's just that he's hesitant. This is not the absence of faith. This is just the caution of faith. So when he talks about this fleece, it's just like, "Lord, I think I heard you say this, but it is so big, I'm going to need some encouragement." I mean, that's what he was saying. "It's so big, I can't even hardly believe it." So he does the whole fleece thing. Here it is again. God is not ashamed to stoop down and reassure us in our fears. Think about it this way. Let's suppose you and your three-year-old were going by a neighbor's yard, and a huge dog jumps up on the fence and barks at you. And your three-year-old comes running into your arms, frightened. What are you going to say? "You sissy. What are you doing?" No, are you going to say, "You chicken. Come on, it's just a dog"? No, you're going to take that little child into your arms. You're going to say, "Honey, it's okay. You know, I'll walk with you right by this dog. It's going to be okay." That's what you do. And guys, that's what God does with us. He's patient with us in our weakness. Can things overwhelm us sometimes when we feel afraid? Yes, they can. Every single one of us has been in situations where the treadmill got to us, correct? Isn't that true? No doubt. And if we listen, how does God encourage us in times like this? Well, if we listen to His Word, we perhaps listen to Him by His Spirit. Maybe He arranged a certain set of circumstances for us. Maybe He'll speak to us through somebody around us. If we listen, we will often find God's encouragement. And that's exactly what happens for Gideon. He is so encouraged, he tells all his soldiers to get up. "We're going to get going." Now, the story, of course, ends. It doesn't end, but here's the next part of it. We're not going to read it, but the next part of it is this way. Happens this way. He divides his 300 soldiers into three different groups of 100 guys. And as they line up, he says, "All right, guys, line up. I have some things to hand to you." And of course, you can imagine these soldiers going, "Okay, good. We finally get the spears. This is good. We finally get the swords. Okay, he's going to hand out shields. This is so cool. We're looking for some weapons here." Okay, so they line up. What does Joshua give them? "Okay, first of all, here's the ram's horn or the trumpet. Here, you all get these ram horn. This is good. Okay, next, here's a large pot. Here, take that. Take the pots. Okay, notice there's a torch in the pot. Okay, good. Now, Remember, too, you all have your voices to use, so that'll be good, too. These guys have large pots, a torch, and a ram's horn, and that's all they've got. So somewhere close to midnight, these 300 guys, they get up close to the camp of Midian, and they start blowing their ram's horns and breaking their jars and shining their torches and yelling out, "A sword for the Lord and for Gideon." Now, the result is found in verse 22. Look what it says. When the 300 trumpets sounded, the Lord caused the men throughout the camp to turn on each other with their swords. The army fled. Israelites from Naphtali, Asher, and Manasseh were called out, and they pursued the Midianites. So, guys, of course this plan does seem rather ingenious, does it not? I mean, it's pretty smart. They have a few men, you just make a lot of noise. But, guys, I want you to notice something here. These 300 guys do not suddenly become, again, great men. They're essentially hornblowers in this passage. That's it. That's all they do. And then verse 22 tells us what we should think about it. The Lord caused the men throughout the camps to turn on each other. The Lord did it. Now, did he use these guys? Yeah. Just like he wants to use us in many ways. But we should never, ever think that, you know, that we did it. It's like, you know, here we are. You know what? When Jesus came into Jerusalem on a donkey and they all clapped for Jesus, I don't think the donkey was thinking, "Wow, they think a lot of me," okay? No, they were clapping for Jesus, okay? Not the donkey, okay? And that's what's happening here again. The result is pretty clear. God did it, but it was God. Now, here we see both the truths. God insists on the necessity of our weakness, and we see it right here. Why? So we'll trust in him. We'll turn to him often. We will get his strength into our life. And then, in the midst of our struggles, he also encourages us, where he says, "Man, I want to encourage you to know that I am with you." And it can happen in all different kinds of ways. Now, many, many times I'm encouraged in prayer where God will speak to my heart and I'll say, "Lord, I don't feel like I can do this." And the Lord will just gently speak back to me. But there are many ways in which God can speak. You know, years ago when we started building this building, you know, and it just occurred to me last service, when we built this building, we were about 300 people. And when we started to build this building, this is a pretty large building, guys. When we started to build this building, I had a building committee, a building team, and on that team was a guy named Dennis Ilonka. And Dennis has been in our church for 16 years, so he's a man of faith. And at the very beginning of the process, sometimes I would say, "Man, I hope I heard right from God. I hope we heard right." And Dennis would say something like, "We have heard from God, and that's enough for me." And all of a sudden I realized, wow, I'm encouraged. God was using Dennis to remind me of what God had said. See, God can use all kinds of things to encourage us if we will listen. So if you're in the midst of some difficulty, first of all, of course, get comfortable with your weakness. If you're in the midst of some challenge, get comfortable with your weakness. Turn often to God, and as you do, keep your ears open for the ways in which God would encourage you and strengthen you. Now, one more lesson. It's a kind of a twist on this whole thing. And that is simply this. Sometimes we face unexpected causes of weakness or sources of weakness. Remember, we're talking about how God wants us to get comfortable with our weakness in the sense that we depend upon him. But I want you to know, in the midst of your crisis, in the midst of your difficulty or challenge, sometimes people will come against you and that to try to weaken you, and that could be detrimental to what God wants to do in your life. So yes, get comfortable with God's weakness and your dependence upon him, but don't allow others to come against you and weaken you. And I hate to tell you this, if you're a Christian, this is going to be so sad, and I want you to know it doesn't happen. Well, I don't see it at Lighthouse, but I want you to know it's so sad sometimes. The greatest discouragement often comes from the circle of God's people. I hate to say that. It really is true. Because it's just the way we're built. Look at Judges 8:1. Here's Joshua. These many nights are running. He's gathered together several tribes to go chase them. And Ephraim was one of those tribes. Now, after they finished chasing them, here's what the Ephraimites say. Now, the Ephraimites asked Gideon, "Why have you treated us like this? Why didn't you call us when you went to fight Midian?" And they criticized him sharply, but he answered them. Boy, what have I accomplished compared to you guys? Aren't the gleaning of Ephraim's grapes better than the full grape harvest of Abiezer? Meaning, that was a proverb of that day. So he used a proverb. And then he says this. God gave Oreb and Zeeb, these are the Midianite leaders, into your hands. Well, what was I able to do compared to you guys? And after that, the resentment against him subsided. Guys, I'm going to go right to the center here. The Ephraimites are saying, you had no right to start fighting without consulting us. What are they doing? It's just pride. It's just passion for recognition. It's all about status. And of course, that might have distracted Gideon. You know, he might have chosen to give these guys he might have just launched into them. But that would have weakened him. It would have weakened his position. And the way he handles it helps us here. Why? Because we see, well, the unity of God's people is pretty important. And Gideon maintains that unity. He's pretty quick-witted. He gives them a little proverb. Oh, just the gleanings of your grapes are better than our full grapes. That is so true. He's telling them that. And then he uses common sense psychology, and he tells them, you guys caught those two kings? Yeah. What did I do compared to what you did? Now, of course, he had only just routed 100,000 guys with 300 guys. So, you know, this is pretty stupid, really. But he says to them, oh, you did so much. Now, what's the lesson here? Hey, how much better it is to even be hurt, to not insist on your rights, and to not insist on glory. He would have been distracted by these guys. These guys are coming against him. He could have been weakened. His position could have been weakened. And he actually could have done the job less well. Instead, he says, well, no. What's important here is not who gets the glory. And this is one of Satan's biggest schemes. He gets God's people seeking glory, jockeying for position. That's what politics in church is all about and why we have resisted it for 19 years. No politics at Lighthouse. No one jockeying for position or for power. No way. Because it always results in this kind of garbage, I can only call this. And guys, Gideon wasn't having any of it. But you see, a second truth, Gideon didn't take his eyes off the enemy. What happens when people come against us? It weakens our position often because we get our eyes off the enemy. We're just obsessed with something else. And so Gideon had too much to do to let these guys do that to them. Because accusations often distract us from what God has us to do. In other words, I want you to know this. If you realize your weakness before God, you turn to Him often, don't allow others to make you weak. Don't allow others to get you off track. Unfortunately, this even went to another level. We don't have time to talk about it much, but in verse 4, you see a whole other way in which Gideon was going to be distracted. Look what it says in verse 4. Gideon and his 300 men, exhausted, yet kept keeping up the pursuit. They came to the Jordan, crossed it, and he said to the men of Succoth, give my troops some bread. They are worn out, and I'm still pursuing Zeba and Zalmunna, the kings of Midian. But the officials of Succoth said, Do you already have the hands of Ziba and Zalmunna in your possession? Why should we give bread to your troops? Loosely translated, this means no way. Okay, that's what it means. So then Gideon says, just for that, when the Lord has given Zalmunna and Ziba into my hands, I will tear your flesh with desert thorns and briars. And by the way, this happens to a second town as well. He goes to a second town. They don't give him anything either. Now, you can almost understand it. They're thinking, well, okay, yeah, Gideon has defeated these guys, and we're part of Israel, but hey, if he doesn't get them fully, they could come back and hurt us. And so, what are they doing? They're straddling the fence. And you ask, well, why does Gideon treat them differently than he treated the Ephraimites? The Ephraimites were just prideful. At least they were sticking with God and with him, okay? He handled it well, and that's what happened. But these guys are faithless. These guys have misplaced priorities. You know what they've done? They've elevated safety and security above God and God's people. Nope, they're saying safety, it's misplaced priorities. Safety and security. That's the most important thing. Not God, not God's people, not God's work. No way. So what happens? Since they are sided with Israel's enemies, they were treated as Israel's enemies. It's a very tragic thing. So Gideon isn't supported by God's people. Gideon's working on this amazing victory. And yet, what happens? Various people come against him, trying to weaken his position. Friends, I have some instruction. Do not allow even God's people to disillusion you or to distract you or to weaken you. Don't let someone else's behavior determine what you do. Don't let someone else's behavior put you on a wrong track. Don't let someone else's pride make you weak. Don't do it. Now, I want to come back to here we are at 2 Corinthians 12 again. My grace is sufficient, for my power is made perfect in weakness. And therefore, Paul says, therefore, I will boast all the more gladly about my weaknesses, so that Christ's power may rest in me. What did Paul mean? Now get this, what did Paul mean? I'm getting comfortable with my weakness. Why? Because over and over again, it sends me back to God. Over and over again, it helps me to remember the truth. That no matter if I was even stronger, if I had less weaknesses, I would still be dependent upon the God of the universe to take me where he wants to take me. We Christians are not typical heroes. We're weak. We're imperfect. And that's the reason God insists on our weakness, that we know it, that we know we're dependent on man. That's the reason he will come often to encourage us, even in the midst of our weakness. The one thing he doesn't want to happen is for you to allow others to get you off track, others to make you feel even weaker than you are. Judges 7 and 8 say in story form what 2 Corinthians says in a teaching form. My power is made perfect in weakness. And that means that every believer listening to my voice needs to get comfortable with his or her weakness before God. And if you do, you will better walk in God's power. And that's the only way to live as a believer. It's the only way to live as a believer.
We trust you are inspired and challenged by this message. For additional resources and information about Lighthouse Christian Center and its ministries, check out our website at www.lighthousehome.org or contact us at 253-848-2028.